Hello, and welcome to episode 16 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panellists include local judge, tournament organiser, and contributor to the Australian Tabletop Gaming Network, Thomas Daniel.
Welcome to Store Championship season, people.
Runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals, Liam Prasad.
Hey everyone, how you doing?
Two-time Store Champion and three-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor, Wilfie Horrig.
Hi everyone.
2014 Australian National Champion and 2014 World's Top 16 competitor, Jesse Marshall.
I have to say, Brian, it is an absolute pleasure to be here.
And I'm Brian Holland, 2014 Australian Nationals Top 8 competitor. Before we begin tonight, I just want to pass it over to Judge Thomas Daniel, who's got a very exciting announcement to make.
A while ago, when Jesse was heading to Worlds, we wanted to do something kind of a bit special. I think by at that stage, we hadn't really gone too deep on the podcast, but we actually got a special Winning Agenda playmat printed out, which he took to Worlds. You can actually check out the pictures on Twitter and Facebook. And we actually had quite a lot of people ask where we got it. And they actually wanted to buy some, so we've actually partnered with inkedplaymats.com, maker of that fine playmat. And you can actually go buy yourself a copy, $20 US. A little bit of that goes to us as well, so you're actually supporting us at the same time as getting a sweet playmat.
We're going to start the episode tonight with the first installment in what will be a series of segments on the meta strategies. And tonight's segment will be on control decks. So, Jesse, could you just explain what a control deck is and how to identify the aspects of one?
So we've broken this down into three main meta strategies, and this goes across co-op decks and runner decks. We're grouping each deck or the strategy of each deck into one of three broad groups. The three broad groups are aggressive decks or aggro decks, mid-range decks, and control decks. Aggressive decks are attempting to get short-term resource advantage and place short-term pressure on their opponents at the expense of being able to compete in the long game. Mid-range decks are trying to establish a basic early game defense, either as runner or corporation, and then play some reasonably powerful middle-costed cards around probably the 4 to 7 credit range that will allow them to place some pressure in the mid-game on their opponent. So they may be slightly vulnerable in the early game, and they may be slightly vulnerable in the late game, but they will be able to use some relatively powerful cards in the middle game to try and leverage a win. Control decks are willing to give up quite a bit of impetus in the early game and try to gain resources at a rate that is faster than what their opponent can gain resources in order to set up a situation where it's inevitable that they will win the game unless their opponent is able to ride the odds. So they will set up a situation where their opponent may only be able to run once every 2 or 3 turns by the time they have all their ice defenses set up, or they may be trying to set up a situation where they're seeing 4 or 5 cards from R&D every turn in order to try and stop their opponent from drawing agendas and place maximum pressure on their opponent and make them feel, and make it as likely as possible that they are going to be scoring agendas themselves. Control decks are willing to give up some of the early game impetus, potentially allowing their opponents to take advantage of that and get closer towards winning in the early game. But if a control player is able to stay unfazed by their opponent's early progression and rely on their greater resource accumulation and the power of their late game cards, then they may be able to leverage those to stage somewhat of a comeback, even from a situation where they're 5 or 6 agenda points down, and come over the top of their opponent and win using the superior power of their superior resource accumulation, but also the superior power of their more expensive cards.
And Jesse, on that, what are just a couple of decks on either side which are current archetypes which are control decks?
Well, I think we saw some great examples of Replicating Perfection at Worlds doing exactly that, coming back from often 6 points down as the corporation being on 0 points as Replicating Perfection and the runner being on 6 points, and yet the Replicating Perfection player was able to come back and grind their way to a win using that superior resource accumulation, but also the tax that they were able to place on the runner and drain out the runner's resources so that they were able to run very infrequently. So that's one corp archetype. Another one is the Haas Bioroid Glacier archetype, which attempts to set up very high strength ice, layer bioroids in front of each other so that the runner can't just click through them, so that they're forced to spend their credits and use their breakers to get through, and do that in such a manner that, again, the runner can't make efficient runs frequently enough that they can stop the core from scoring out. On the runner side, you've got Kate decks, be they based on prepaid voice pad or based on a professional contacts economy. I personally play a professional contacts economy, and I find that that allows me the inevitability of having superior resource accumulation across the whole game. You do admittedly give up a little bit more than the prepaid voice pad variant in the early game because you're investing 5 credits in your contacts early on, which is quite a big upfront investment. But you do have that inevitability of the fact that you're doubling the resources that you're accumulating for every click over the course of the game. So that's a good example of a runner control deck.
Liam, could you give us some advice on how to play with a control deck?
Yeah, certainly. Just like Jesse was just saying, when you're playing a control deck, you have built your deck in such a way that you're giving up early game advantage in order to arrive at a position of inevitability somewhere down the line, sometimes often very far down the line, sometimes less far down the line. So great ways to do this are to get your professional contacts on early if you're running a Kate Maker's Eye deck with R&D interface. So mulliganing towards that professional context is the most immediate way you can play with this deck. Likewise, I've been playing HB Glacier for quite a while now and testing a lot of different aspects of it, and I've found that hands with lots of eyes, where you can deploy a piece of ice every single turn, just install a card every single turn and really leverage that card ability to gain the credit every single turn, is fantastic. That's part and parcel of what you want to be doing. You want the game to go long so that you can gain that credit every single turn, or so that you can use that professional contacts every single turn. The first thing to remember when you're playing decks like this is that you need to be very wary of where you spend your resources, because if you spend your resources responding very heavily to early game pressure, often you won't have the streams online to actually then develop into the game plan where you can win. So I think the most concrete example I can think of this is if in Kate you spend all of your immediate resources on breakers and Maker's Eye in the first few turns, and then you need to click for credits until you can play a contacts, and then you've lost two turns there, or you've clicked for credits whilst you're installing breakers, and every time you did that, you lost the card that could have been drawn there. Or every time you installed two breakers in one turn, you lost the advantage of Kate's ability of gaining that extra credit. Make sure you position yourself to go to the long game. Make sure you actually like expect to go there and intend to go there and play consistently with that plan.
Wilfie, how would you recommend playing against a control deck?
As Shilzy mentioned correctly, control decks are all about squeezing your opponent's resources. So they're not as concerned with time pressure like aggressive and mid-range decks are. They're concerned with overwhelming inevitability in the late game. That needs to be at the forefront of your mind when you're playing against a control deck, and that manifests in different ways as the runner playing against a controlling corporation deck and as the corp playing against a controlling runner deck. As a runner playing against a controlling corp deck, the most important thing is to not squander your resources making runs early. Those decks usually don't have very many agendas, because the whole point is to minimize your vulnerability in the early game, so you can draw agendas only when you need them in the late game, and once you have the lead on board, you can turn that lead into a win and as quickly as possible. So you compress the number of agendas that you have so that you draw them only at the right time, and you can get rid of them when you draw them and it's not at the right time. So, for example, one of the things I see people do a lot is running when they're only going to see one card on HQ and R&D. While that can be okay in some situations, when you really, really need to get agendas from your corp opponent before they score them, such as in matchups against aggressive decks, against control decks, that's usually not good. So the key cards to look for are cards to make your economy last in the long game. For example, professional contacts is the main one from the runner side, but of course there can be many others like Magnum Opus, Security Testing, Wildside, Aesop's Pawn Shop, anything like that can allow you to make the best use of your clicks while not being as fast as some other alternatives, but being more efficient in terms of building resources. And from the corp playing against a controlling runner, it's about making them fight a battle on time or on tempo when they're not equipped to fight that kind of battle. So trying to score as fast as possible and to pressure their resources early so that you don't get into the late game where they have the overwhelming advantage and can get into any server they want without spending too many of their resources. Or if they have enough resources that even if you have very taxing servers, they can still get in and end the game before you can. Those two things are very important. It's very important to place time pressure on your opponent as a corp against a controlling runner so that they'll have to choose between accumulating those resources efficiently and stopping you from executing your plan of scoring agendas. And even if you are a slow corp deck yourself, it's very important to know that you need to score agendas early, and they're not going to be as good at stopping you as a more aggressive runner deck, which can easily punish you for doing something like that.
Yeah, and I just want to really emphasize what Wilfie said there about not necessarily running HQ early, looking for the agendas that the corp has in hand. This comes back to the way the corporation is developing their remote and, in general, what is the corp's control over where their agendas go. Against an aggressive deck like Near Earth Hub or maybe like HB Fast Advance, you will need to find those agendas early because they have the capacity to score them out of hand. However, against a controlling corporation deck, because they don't necessarily have the capacity to score those agendas out of hand, they will need to put them into a remote. And so simply having the ability to threaten that remote closes the windows in which the corp can score those. They have inevitability at the same time, though, so they can just continue to draw cards and one day put two Ash and a Caprice Nisei in that server, or place traps in there, threaten to score and force you to run through that remote, or even just putting NAPD contracts into that remote and forcing you to run through it multiple times, taxing you until they can chain through a few agendas and eventually just win the game. When you're playing as a runner against a control or corp deck, you do really need to identify that portion of the game where the corp is looking to start scoring, and then fire off your legworks, or then fire off your maker's eyes, or then parasite down HQ and just attack it aggressively, because that's how you're actually going to get the job done.
Next, we're just going to move into a deck tech on chaos theory. I wanted to build a chaos theory deck for a long time. I really like the fact that she has a smaller deck, which I found makes her just a little bit more consistent than some other runners, and I was very attracted to the additional memory. Liam, Shilzy, and I sat down one afternoon and started to put the deck together. We wanted to be fueled by the power of Magnum Opus, seeing as chaos theory is the only runner that can realistically host Opus as well as a rig of proficient breakers. Similar to Jesse's Kate list, the basic idea of the deck is to mulligan for Magnum Opus or draw for it in the early game, as he does with professional contacts. Seeing as Chaos Theory's advantage comes at the early game, you want to have as much economy as fast as possible, and for this reason, unlike some of the lists you'll see online, we chose to include a full economy package, which was 3 Dirty Laundry, 3 Sure Gamble. After a few games with Chaos Theory, I found that I had stacks of cash very, very quickly, and next you wanted to begin setting up a rig and face-checking the ice, so using self-modifying code and clone chip to get your programs out very quickly. The deck really favors Atman. The excess cash it generates makes it really viable. The mutability of Atman isn't as taxing as it is in some other decks because you've got very reliable, consistent access to a lot of money. The main thing that differentiates Chaos Theory to Kate is that she has a much more aggressive beginning, while Kate's ability, I believe, is, while it's also passive, drawing and storing with contacts makes your economy slightly slower than Chaos Theory, so instead you have a much stronger mid-game. So I was attracted to Chaos Theory because it's a slightly more aggressive deck than most of the Kate lists. For that reason, you really want to exploit the early game as much as possible, installing multi-access cards like R&D Interface without taxing your huge credit supply. I found Chaos Theory to have a good matchup against fast advanced decks most of the time, as she can get in quickly and reliably. Conversely, she's also quite good against Glacier decks because, for the reasons we were talking about earlier, in the beginning you can sit back and not run and set up your rig and just reliably accumulate quite a lot of resources to try and gain the advantage back in the late game. Where I found this deck fell short, however, was still in the memory. So despite the ID ability allowing you to house your Magnum Opus, there were a number of occasions where I found myself stifled because I hadn't drawn one of the only two Desperados. This again is another advantage a professional contacts build has. While Chaos Theory can get her money very quickly, she works through her deck much slower. So a small deck size does help to mitigate that a little, but I found myself very frustrated on turns when I just had to sit there and dig for little to no value just to find my extra memory for my Desperado. If I were to tinker a little bit more with it, I'd probably try to fit in a mem chip, but so many of the card slots are already so important, and it's really hard to find places for them.
One thing we did discuss was perhaps not necessarily playing Desperado, but playing Astrolabe as it comes down cheaper, you get to play a whole three of them, and once you have one, it actually does assist you in this in a weakness in the deck, which is that you often have a lot of difficulty drawing cards. You don't necessarily want to have very burst card draw like in Quality Time or like in Diesel, because once you have Magnum Opus in play, those effects overwhelm you and you end up going to discard quite a lot, which in turn overwhelms the clone chips.
The main issue that I was referring to, while Astrolabe would mitigate some of the drawing problems that Chaos Theory has, I'm still playing three Diesel and two Quality Time. The most efficient way to go find your break is, because you're not drawing as many cards as like a professional context build would be, is to use self-modifying code, and even at times self-modifying code with a clone chip, and being on that threshold of memory where you can't install your self-modifying code without installing over something, because you don't have that extra memory from a chip or a desperado, was really quite stifling. So maybe I would try it with Astrolabe instead of Desperado, but that's a desperado is insane. So
absolutely,
when you have it, yeah, it's great. Yeah,
like so. it's very clearly a weakness of Chaos Theory in the mid game, when they can pressure you to find your second breaker and you can't install the Lotus. You can't install the self-modifying code to actually find that, be it against like mid-range Grey Alice builds or against decks that have, you know, are prepared to put one of each kind of ice on a remote server. You often just can't find that third breaker before you actually draw into it, which is difficult because you haven't spent the game drawing cards like you would with professional contacts. So maybe we can mitigate this a little bit with the new card from the source, Earthrise Hotel, which again is perfect for this kind of deck. But when we talked about it in our The Source card review, we did talk about how it was perfect for these kind of decks that have a lot of money but don't necessarily have access to card draw. And so I think in the future we'll probably come back to our Chaos Theory looking at playing a suite of Earthrise Hotels, because it is insanely good in that kind of deck.
Yeah, I think Earthrise Hotel would fit in really well. And like, one of the things that's turned some people away from Earthrise Hotel is the 4 install cost, and that, you know, Chaos Theory doesn't really sniff at that. Well, one of the things I did test around with both of, and this will be somewhat controversial, is the deck was originally playing 2 Parasite, and I found Parasite to be good, but I found the other issue was my only multi-access cards were R&D interface. There were occasions, as it always happens, where running R&D, even if you're seeing multiple cards, is not efficient because of the ice. I needed another avenue, so I cut the Parasites and played Legworks instead. And having that extra avenue of multi-access into HQ was really, really helpful. And I didn't find myself missing the Parasites too much.
Yeah, the hosting the Parasite was a big problem again.
Yeah, exactly.
It was the same problem you were having with self-modifying code and Magnum Opus. You just don't have the memory for it coming into the mid-game. And, you know, unless you're prepared to play Magnum Opus and host a console like the Toolbox, which Earthrise Hotel at 4 is manageable. The Toolbox at 9, I think, is probably outside the realm of possibility. You got to keep an open mind about these things, because otherwise we'll just miss out on these great decks that do have a strong place in the metagame, even if they don't play the cards we conventionally just call good. And yeah, maybe Chaos Theory, like playing the Magnum Opus, does make you want to also play another Akametsu Memchip. Maybe it's Astrolabe, maybe it's Earthrise Hotel. There are lots of avenues to try and work on this problem. So,
and also a quick shout out to Inti, because Inti is really good. Obviously, your cash supply is still finite, but having all that money did make Inti better than it is in most other decks, I think. And being able to fetch it and install it for 0 actually, I think, sometimes took your opponent by surprise, because most of the time they're thinking you're going to go get Corroda, and they calculate what credits I have to break their ice with it, and it did get me a few accesses that I probably wouldn't have got if I was playing Corroda. So,
Especially again when you're playing against faster Corp decks, which is certainly what the Chaos Theory deck here was tailored to beat. When they are going to play cards like Paperwall or cards like Quandary, having cheap breakers is exactly where you want to be, because you often only need to break a 0 strength or a 1 strength piece of ice, and in the case of Paperwall, you only need to break it once. But if you install a larger breaker, most of the time what you get out of a larger breaker is, in fact, base strength. Gordian Blade or the Torch are only really differentiated by that base strength. And the same goes for Zoo Keymaster. So in a deck like Chaos Theory, where your money is not necessarily a problem, but what you do want to have is the capacity to go legwork on turn 2. Or, you know, in your own personal build, you might go Account Siphon on turn 2 or whatever. You know, you do want cheaper breakers for sure.
We're just going to do a quick mailbag segment. Our first question comes from James D. James writes, "Hi guys, I wondered if you had any advice on trying to compete in tournaments with a limited card pool. As a player who is still in the process of buying all the cards, how should I go about filling the gaps of commonly used cards? For example, I'm finding that I'm not having creation and control for cards like Daily Casts, Dirty Laundry, Clone Chip, or Self-Modifying Code to be pretty detrimental to my runner decks. So, Jesse, what's your opinion there?
Yeah, it is extremely detrimental not to have crucial cards in your deck. I know when I first started playing, it was just after Creation and Control had come out, and I got the core set and I got all of the cards from the first cycle, and I put together my Kate deck and I was going down to a tournament and people were playing Daily Cast and Dirty Laundry, and I was like, wow, that's a much more efficient way to make money than what I have. And Netrunner being a living card game, it really does lend itself to needing to have the whole card pool available to you in order to make decks that are going to compete. And unfortunately, for each faction, the cards that are crucial are spread across a lot of packs. Unfortunately, if you want to build multiple decks, you're going to need, therefore, to get pretty much all of the packs. And if you're going to make competitive decks, you're going to need multiple copies of the core set. And that's just the reality of what you're going to need if you want to make decks that are competitive at a high level. There are some ways, if you want to really do your research and figure out one corp and one runner deck that you're pretty sure you want to play, you can do it without needing to necessarily purchase all the packs from all three cycles, but you are going to need to get the core neutral cards, which come from the core set from Creation and Control, and some from other packs such as Double Time, which has NAPD Contract and Quandary, and then you're going to need to get the packs that have the core cards for that archetype, because if you don't have the core cards, you're just not going to be able to compete.
Yeah, I have certainly made it something of a little project of mine to try and find two decks, a corp deck and a runner deck, that are both fairly competitive, that require as few data packs as possible. And ironically, I guess, with regards to this question, most of the time when I do land on something that seems okay with one base set and with one runner deck and one corp deck that are both, you know, maybe tier 1.5, competitive most of the time, you almost always need Creation and Control. Creation and Control is fundamental to modern Netrunner, I would say, in the same way that decks that want to play three Desperados need three base sets, decks that want to play any shape of cards whatsoever, and often just any runner cards that have an economy that's flexible and have an economy that's strong, need a copy of Creation and Control just for Daily Cast and for Dirty Laundry. At the same time, if you want to play Anarch lists, a lot of Anarch lists that focus on Parasite, maybe Noise lists that focus on Parasite as well, you'll maybe end up playing three copies of Clone Chip, in which case you'll need Creation and Control. I'll post some lists with this episode that I have been able to get kind of solid that require one core set, one Creation and Control, and four data packs, which is kind of the least I've been able to bring it down to. So really, I don't think there is a way to make a very strong competitive deck with anything less than that. And even then, these lists are very inflexible. So
our next question comes from Samuel James Brent. He is the cowardly host of the Gas MTG podcast, which you can check out at gasmtg.com, particularly if you want to hear our panelist here, Wilfred Horrig, ramble on some more about Magic the Gathering. You should definitely check that out. It's three gentlemen who truly hail from the swamp. Samuel writes, "Hi guys, how does your choice of runner deck influence your choice of corp deck, and vice versa?" This is a very interesting question. Liam, what do you think?
Yeah, I think this question kind of prods at a topic I'm very, very passionate about, and that is time management in tournament settings. In general, I like to talk about the analogy between memory and time. These are your two fundamental resources in competitive play, regardless of what game it is. And so this is why, to me, habits like the ones we talked about in our last episode, habits like reducing ice to numbers when you always play the same breakers, habits like counting your clicks rather than maybe using a click tracker, pretty as they may be, I find that in a tournament setting, I would prefer to work a rhythm into my language of saying 1, 2, 3, 4. And then when the game does slow down on large turns, I make sure that my opponent and I both make a note of it. That's when you pull out the click trackers and you turn them face down. How does this question and this topic interact? More often than not, when I choose a corp deck or I choose a runner deck, I take into heavy account which of the two decks I'm prioritizing. Maybe I have a Corp deck I want to test this week, or maybe my Runner deck hasn't changed forever and I'm just shaking things up. So I prioritize one of those two things. I make an estimate on how long it's going to take me to play a game with that, and I make sure that the Corp deck I'm playing, when I make an estimate about how long that game will take, their sum is less than 50 minutes. Because that's the thing. Going to a draw absolutely sucks. Going to a draw is bad for everyone in the room. Literally everyone in the room. Everyone at home. Everyone on the road. Everyone out at the restaurant. Going to time effects. Literally everyone in your life. That's really good advice from me to you.
Personally, I favor aggressive decks, but I do like control decks in some aspects of Netrunner. So I really like playing a fast advance Corp deck, and if I'm doing so, then maybe I play a slightly slower Runner deck.
If you do go the time in the round and you do come to a draw, not only did you not get that extra point, your game also didn't really come to an end. And so we end up having a lot of discussions about how do we decide how draws allocate points. You know, is it fair? Is it equitable? In reality, draws shouldn't really happen. Any discussion on what do we do when we come to a draw can simply be nullified by simply saying, well, we can speed up. So getting into good habits where you speed up, honestly, just a much better method than solving what happens when players go to a draw. They will also always go to a draw. These things do happen just as events get larger and larger and larger. And so those conversations do need to happen. But at your local meta, you know, just get into a habit of not necessarily going into the tank every turn. Don't spend 30 seconds between every click. Plan your turns. Plan your turns in advance and just get into good habits like drawing a card early in your turn. And when you know that you don't have your entire turn planned out, just draw a card. Sure, draw a card. Does this fix my turn's plan? Great. Well, then I've got three clicks to do this, this, and this.
That's about all we have time for this week. We'll be back next Monday, as always. In the meantime, if you want to get in contact with us, you can shoot us an email at thewinningagenda.com. Hit us up on Twitter at @winningagenda, or you can go check out our Facebook page, The Winning Agenda. Until next week, we hope you have a great time and a great start to your store championship season. We look forward to hearing from you. See you guys.